This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. When you turn the tap in your home, you expect to get clear, clean, running water, regardless of how much you can pay for it. When you flip a light switch, you expect a stable, steady flow of power, just like everyone else. It's a utility. Everyone needs it, and everyone deserves equal access to it. But is high-speed internet access a utility too? That question is at the heart of a high-profile debate at the Federal Communications Commission. The chair of the FCC plans to loosen the government's oversight of high-speed internet providers, rolling back rules from the Obama administration. The current rules, known as net neutrality, treat broadband like a utility. No pay-for-play fast lanes that let certain websites or services load ahead of others. Is this the way it should be? Or will giving internet service providers more leeway give you better options? Joining us in studio to discuss it for the hour is Tom Wheeler, who was chairman of the FCC during the Obama administration. He is now a fellow at the Brookings Institution. Before the FCC, he was CEO of the Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association and of the National Cable Television Association, the main lobbying groups for the cell phone and cable industries. Tom Wheeler, welcome to 1A.
Joshua, thank you. Great to be here.
Also with us is Cecilia Kong, a tech reporter for the New York Times, who has covered net neutrality extensively. Cecilia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Aaron is the president and CEO of Free Press, an advocacy group that supports net neutrality and opposes media consolidation. Craig, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back.
And joining us from Clemson University is economics professor Thomas Hazlett, the director of Clemson's Information Economy Project. He has served as the chief economist for the FCC. His new book is called The Political Spectrum, The Tumultuous Liberation of Wireless Technology from Herbert Hoover to the Smartphone. Professor Hazlett, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Cecilia Kong, let's start with the basics. What exactly is net neutrality? Does my running water, free power analogy hold up?
It's a good one, actually, Joshua. Net neutrality is the basic idea that you as an internet user should be able to access whatever you want on the internet. As long as it's legal, there should be no preferred access to certain kinds of videos or certain kinds of websites. There shouldn't be faster downloads or slower downloads dictated by the internet service provider. The idea is that the consumer is in control, not necessarily the internet service provider.
Before we go a little further, we throw this word broadband around a lot. What exactly do we mean when we say broadband?
Broadband is high-speed internet. It is 25 megabits down, 6 up. Sorry, I'm looking at Tom Wheeler because he defined it.
Correct.
He upped, actually, the definition. And it should allow you to have very fast access to pretty much everything that's available on the internet today, particularly videos, what have you, to do all your homework, to do all the work that you need to do on the internet, but at home.
There's also a bit of legalese in net neutrality, and it became very clear from hearing some of the questions we have from listeners that the legalese is muddy. So we want to try to go very, very carefully and casually through all of this. Tom Wheeler, one of the pieces of the law that comes up at the center of this debate is Title I and Title II. Now, immediately I can hear eyes glazing over all across the country. But briefly, what is this Title I, Title II thing, and why does it matter to this?
Well, historically, Joshua, our networks have been regulated as common carriers. And a common carrier concept is that everybody gets on. First come, first serve, non-discriminatory access. That's what is at the heart of Title II, and that is what is the heart of net neutrality.
We're talking about, like, phone networks?
Phone networks got on that way. You know, so let's go back. Why was AOL successful? Because this great entrepreneur by the name of Steve Case had the opportunity to say to people all over the country, hook up a modem to your telephone and access my network. He didn't have to, and access my service. He didn't have to ask anybody's permission to do that. He just did it. And look what happened. That's what enabled the internet to take off, was that kind of open access. And what then developed was that the folks who were running those networks said, wait a minute, I want a piece of that action too. And all of a sudden, we started getting into all of the issues that led to net neutrality.
So, I just want to make sure we're clear. So, Title II, this aspect of the law that regulates phone networks, is kind of analogous to the way that net neutrality treats broadband, that it's the kind of thing that everybody should have open, free access to that can't be sped up, slowed down by the provider.
Well, let me be real specific, Joshua, that what we said in our decision was that internet service providers were indeed common carriers, just like phone companies had been common carriers, but that we changed the nature of some of the requirements that had traditionally been put on common carriers to reflect the new modern situation.
Speaking of the new situation, let's hear from the Trump administration's FCC chairman, Ajit Pai, who is pushing to reverse the rules that were put in place under President Obama, under Mr. Wheeler's administration at the FCC. Here is what Mr. Pai said last month in Washington when he announced this plan. Listen.
When we are saddled with FCC rules that will deny many Americans high-speed internet access and jobs, doing nothing is nothing doing. Going forward, we cannot stick with regulations from the Great Depression that were meant to micromanage Ma Bell. Instead, we need rules that focus on growth and infrastructure investment, rules that expand high-speed internet access everywhere, rules that give Americans more online choice, faster speeds, and more innovation. In short, digital opportunity. And we are going to deliver.
That is Ajit Pai, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, speaking last month in Washington. Craig Aaron, Mr. Pai talked about denying Americans high-speed access under the current rules and expanding it under the future plans to either remake or remove net neutrality. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with it is it's nonsensical. The net neutrality rules that were passed in 2015 are designed to protect consumers. They're designed to make sure that when you go online, you can go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want, and it's not up to your phone or cable company to decide which websites and services are going to work and which won't. What consumers need are those kind of protections, and they need more choices for service. But nothing this FCC is doing is actually encouraging more competition. But what we've seen from these net neutrality rules is that's exactly what they did. They encouraged competition across the internet ecosystem, giving new companies a chance to find an audience, get online, create all the great things we now take for granted. That was because of that foundation of net neutrality. Net neutrality just means no discrimination. And these Title II rules are so important because they protect two-way communications. My ability to talk to anybody I want, my ability to start something new, a new product, a new service, to go online when I have something important to say and find an audience.
We got a lot of comments from our listeners about this. Nathaniel wrote, "We don't tolerate electric companies manipulating our service to allow KitchenAid products to run without a tariff, but make it so blow dryers barely run because the electric company doesn't want to supply for that use. Why should the American public put up with that from what the FCC previously acknowledged are near monopoly providers of high-speed internet? Companies like Comcast have already held Netflix hostage to seek payment, as if these companies are operating a protection racket. I pay my bill, I should be able to do whatever I want without manipulation with the service I've paid for, just like electricity or water." Professor Thomas Hazlitt, what's wrong with that argument?
Well, yeah, there's a great history to this, and it's already been referenced with examples like AOL coming into the market and in the 1990s exploding, really making the internet mass market. AOL was not a common carrier. In fact, AOL created what was called a walled garden. That was a business model that they pursued. It was in a competitive milieu. The walled garden, where they had their own content and all the subscribers had to go into that that environment, and then gradually they were released to go pursue other opportunities in the open internet. That developed over time through competition. For a long time, the FCC strategy, this is going back decades, was to try to create an atmosphere for innovation that was outside of the regulated common carrier space. And according to many administrations, the real success was unregulation of the internet. And it allowed, first, with access on dial-up in the old days, and we're talking about AOL there, carpet bombing America with these dial-up subscription disks, right, and really creating the mass service. But then what happens is that an unregulated carrier cable starts building broadband. This whole idea of how we get fast internet does not come from the regulated common carrier space. The phone companies that were regulated as common carriers were thought to have the best technology and they would lead the way to faster access. That is not what happened. The unregulated cable operators jumped out and then cable had to catch up. Then cable then the phone companies had to catch up, and the phone companies in the early 2000s were deregulated to try to match cable. They're still trying to catch up.
So we're coming up on a break in just a moment, but I want to make sure that I catch your point, and then I'll let the rest of the panel jump in on the other side. It sounds like what you're saying is that the regulatory environment hamstrung the phone industry from getting in on this broadband revolution in ways that maybe cable companies who provide broadband weren't hamstrung. Is that what you're saying, briefly?
Well, you can say hamstrung, or you can say that the phone company just didn't have the incentive or wherewithal to really be innovative. They had great technology out of Bell Labs, of course, but they didn't deploy. They weren't aggressive, and they finally got beaten in the market with that.
Well, we're going to pause, catch our breath for just a minute. There's a lot more to talk about. We'll continue with Clemson University Professor Thomas Hazlett, former FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, Cecilia Kong of the New York Times, Craig Aaron of Free Press, and with you. On the other side of the break, we will hear from an official at the current FCC. Later, we will also hear from one of the chief lobbyists for the broadband industry, and we'll get to your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. However you're listening, on air or online, you are listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the battle over net neutrality with former FCC Chair Tom Wheeler, Cecilia Kong of the New York Times, Craig Aaron, the President and CEO of Free Press, and Clemson University Economics Professor Thomas Hazlett. We welcome your questions and thoughts about net neutrality as well. Comments on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. We've already gotten a number of great comments. Please do keep them coming. Reed in Richmond, Virginia email. Of all the things that government can do, I believe that free, high-speed internet access would be most effectual to level the economic playing field between the suburbs and inner cities and rural communities. Give everyone, regardless of financial ability, equal access to information. I would vote for almost anyone who ran on that platform. Reed, point well taken. We are actually going to delve deeper into rural broadband access in a future edition of 1A. Everybody on our team agrees that's worth talking about, so stay tuned. We will get to that conversation. Ben wrote on Twitter, if the ISPs slow down the sites I see, then they better well charge less per month. That might lead into some of the options that the FCC is foreseeing with changing these rules, which leads neatly into our next guest. Joining us from the FCC is Matthew Berry, the chief of staff for the FCC's chairman, Ajit Pai. Matthew, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Chairman Pai had said he generally supported the idea behind net neutrality, but the current rules went too far. Under Mr. Pai's preferred outcome, what would stay the same and what would change?
So what would stay the same is having a free and open internet. We had a free and open internet under the so-called Title I framework that you had talked a little bit about from the dawn of the internet age until 2015. And in 2015, we had a sudden change of course, and we adopted utility-style Title II regulations. And these regulations have slowed down investment in high-speed broadband. And so what would change is that we would go back to a Title I framework, have greater investment in high-speed broadband networks, so more people, especially in rural America, can get high-speed broadband internet access. But we would keep the free and open internet that developed under the Title I framework between the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and 2015. This is the framework that saw our internet ecosystem become the envy of the world. Google, Facebook, Netflix, Amazon all became global powerhouses under a Title I framework. And so we would keep a free and open internet and have greater investment in innovation and networks.
I have to admit, I am skeptical that the reason that rural communities don't have better broadband access is because of these regulations. I mean, NPR has built a network that reaches every corner of the United States without the benefit of these regulations or any of these kinds of breaks. And we did it as a nonprofit. Is it really because of these regulations, or do these big companies just don't think rural areas are lucrative?
Well, so I'm certainly not claiming it's solely because of these regulations, but since the Title II framework has come into place, investment in networks has declined by billions of dollars. And when investments aren't made, they tend the most marginal investments are in rural and hard-to-serve areas, so they're the ones that are most hurt. And when you speak about nonprofits, a very interesting fact is that municipal government ISPs, which are nonprofits, 19 of them have written the FCC and said that these Title II regulations have hampered their ability to build out their networks and to offer new services to customers. So this isn't just a matter about ISPs that want to make a profit. Even nonprofit ISPs say that these utility-style regulations that were designed in the 1930s to regulate a monopoly are making it harder for them to serve more of their populations.
I also have to admit skepticism that these big billion-dollar multinational companies will just do the right thing, because it's the right thing as it comes to content, speeding up some and slowing down others. One of our listeners, Joel, tweeted, "Why on earth should we trust net and communications corporations with notoriously bad customer service and predatory practices to keep net neutrality pledges?" Do you trust, does the chairman of the FCC actually trust Verizon, AT&T, Xfinity to honor these net neutrality pledges?
It's not a matter of trust. It's a matter of having a proven legal framework in place that protects a free and open internet. And we had a Title I framework in place from 1996 until 2015, and we had a free and open internet where people could access the content of their choice. So it's not a matter of trusting anyone. It's a matter of having the right legal framework that both gives consumers the freedom that they want on the internet and provides the business incentives so that we can get high-speed internet access to more Americans, particularly in rural areas.
Well, but we're not just talking about access. We're talking about content. I mean, Comcast owns NBC Universal, which includes Sci-Fi, MSNBC, The Golf Channel, Oxygen, I mean, E, and it's all this content. AT&T and Time Warner are thinking about linking up, which includes HBO and CNN and TBS and TNT. These companies are marrying more and more because they see a future where access and content lock together. Why should we trust that Comcast through Xfinity won't throttle CBS or ABC to advantage NBC, for example?
Well, again, as I've said, it's not a matter of trust. It's having the right legal framework in place that prevents that kind of behavior. And under a Title I framework, we did not see that happening on a systemic basis. And more importantly, through things like competition law, that such kinds of anti-competitive conduct should be and is illegal. So I don't think we have any argument about what the end goal is. What we have an argument about is what is the right legal framework for securing those values, as well as other important values, such as having increased network investment and innovation among networks.
What is the next step in this process? What's the timeline look like right now?
So we are having, right now we have started a 90-day public comment period where all affected stakeholders as well as can submit their comments to the FCC. After that 90-day comment period is over, then the FCC will assess those comments and then determine what the appropriate next step is in terms of developing the final rules.
One more thing before I let you go. A lot of people have gotten very acquainted with this issue as a result of Last Week Tonight and John Oliver bringing it up. Does the chairman have any plans to appear on Last Week Tonight or address these concerns directly?
You know, the chairman has done a wide variety of media interviews about the topic, ranging from tech outlets like Recode and CNET to he was on NPR Morning Edition. He was on the PBS NewsHour. So I think he did more interviews in the three-week period where the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking was under consideration, I think, than pretty much any FCC chair has done during a three-week period. So he's been very engaged talking to a wide range of media about the these issues, and I think he'll continue to do that because this is a very important conversation about preserving a free and open internet and having high-speed broadband access for all Americans. So, you know, he's been very public about this, very open and transparent in terms of what he wants to do, and he'll continue to engage with the American people going forward and having a conversation about these issues.
But does the chairman see the value in sitting down with Mr. Oliver, since he has marshaled millions of comments on this matter?
You know, I can't speak for the chairman on that. I do know he's not received any invitation to receive to appear on the show, so I can't speak about a non-existent invitation.
That's Matthew Berry, the Chief of Staff for FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. Matthew, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's continue our conversation now with Tom Wheeler, former FCC chair, Cecilia Kong of the New York Times, Craig Aaron of Free Press, and Clemson University economics professor Thomas Hazlett. Tom Wheeler, you wanted to jump in before the break, and I couldn't get to you. Did you want to jump in now?
Well, I found it interesting that Matthew Berry didn't want to engage in discussions here, but it's important to understand that what we heard was doublespeak. That says, oh, we're in favor of a free and open internet, but we're going to remove all the protections for that. You know, the reality is that the way that Washington talks about things like this anymore is you always cloak it in, oh, let me talk about what the public interest is. Let me talk about rural, not let me talk about how I am freeing up monopolies to be able to control what you see, where you can go. And that's what the issue is here. Let's just, two-thirds of American households, Joshua, have no choice in how they get internet access.
Two-thirds.
They got one provider or less. Two-thirds of them. So we're dealing with a monopoly service here. And the question is, are you going to say that that monopoly service, just like you only have one water company, that monopoly service has the responsibility to deliver you fast, fair, and open access to everything on the internet? That's what the issue is. It's not all these other red herrings that get thrown out. It is we're dealing with a monopoly who wants to be able to extort that monopoly position.
Professor Hazlett, what did you think about what you heard from Matthew? I mean, I do kind of take his argument, and maybe you know more about this than I do, in terms of deregulating some of these industries so they feel free to expand access, but then there's still this content piece that I'm not sure he quite answered. What do you think?
Well, there is a longstanding concern over what antitrust law calls vertical foreclosure, and it's been studied quite a bit, and it has been subject to litigation, and in the cable TV industry, you've seen some cases. There is an antitrust law backstop on this, and you know we've had those laws since 1890. And the question is, you know, when you raise some of these issues about the anti-competitive discrimination, how do you want to handle that? Do you think the antitrust law works, or you need something extra? The FCC is saying, well, we'll give you a little bit extra. They're trying to, you know, strike a middle ground on this. Previous FCCs have also done that, you know, including the last two FCCs under President Obama, and then gone in different directions. Title II this last time, which, you know, what's called the nuclear option, you know, when it was unleashed in 2015. So the fact is that there is competition in the marketplace, not nearly as much as we'd like. For a long time, cable franchises, for example, have been a big impediment in the market. Lack of radio spectrum for wireless competition is a very ongoing problem, and we're all aware of that, and I've just written a book called The Political Spectrum that really makes the pitch for getting much more wireless into the marketplace so that a lot of these problems can be solved with more competition.
Well, and that kind of speaks to what a lot of people in the broadband industry have been talking about, as you said, that there is this desire for more bandwidth so that they can continue to innovate. But we are going to hear from the broadband industry in a minute. I do want Craig, though, to respond to a question from Michael in Cincinnati, who wrote, How does allowing ISPs to offer different speeds for different rates differ from what postal carriers already do? If you want next day delivery, you pay extra, whether you use FedEx, UPS, or the U.S. Postal Service. Greg?
The question is just about who's in control. So if you're talking about should someone be able to pay more to get a higher speed, you know, they want to get 100 megabits instead of 50, sure, that exists and that will continue to exist. What net neutrality is about is those monopolists, those cable and phone companies, actually using their control of the pipes to dictate which websites and services are going to work. So you're already paying them for these high speeds. Your end of that bargain is once you pay, they send you what you've asked for, and that should be anything. That's the way the free and open internet has always worked. That's what consumers demand, and that's what Matt Berry and others are trying to talk their way around, but they can't. They're not telling the truth. The fact is that Title I regulations didn't work. The fact is that in 1996, Title I and Title II were written. They've been contested over the last 10 years. And when the FCC has tried to step in when cable companies did a bad thing, when Comcast got caught messing with BitTorrent, the FCC stepped in, tried to use Title I. The courts told them, you don't have the authority. You can't do it. When the FCC went back, tried to do Title I again, Verizon went to court, sued them. The judges asked them in court, would you discriminate if you got rid of this? They said yes. And they said the FCC doesn't have the authority. The only way the FCC has the authority to step in and protect consumers is using Title II. That's what the FCC did in 2015. And that's just the beginning of the lies. The fact is, investment is up, way up, all over the internet, including among ISPs since 2015. Well, the FCC is trying to cherry pick numbers. It just doesn't add up. Well,
we've been talking a lot about the industry, and I think we should bring in someone from the industry directly before we have to pause once again. And now joining us from Berkeley, California, is Jonathan Spalter. Jonathan is the CEO of U.S. Telecom, the trade group for broadband providers. Jonathan, welcome to 1A.
It's great to be here, Joshua, and hello from your old stomping grounds.
Yes, indeed. I wonder, Jonathan, if you could begin by answering an email from a listener. John in Oklahoma City wrote, "Help me understand how AT&T has any incentive to invest if they have to maintain net neutrality. How do they make money?" Seems like John maybe sees the industry side of all this.
Well, I think it goes... It's very reasonable to understand that companies like AT&T and other broadband innovators have a huge incentive to continue to do what they've done very carefully and serially, which is protect their consumers' right to an open internet, to protect their right to internet freedoms. All internet service providers understand that in a highly competitive market in which they operate, consumers want and deserve the protections of an open internet, the same protections that they've come to enjoy since the inception of the internet, when President Clinton and Chairman Bill Kennard, his Democratic FCC commissioner, working with the Republican Congress, were able to architect a light and flexible and, I think, visionary approach to safeguarding the future of this extraordinary phenomenon we call the internet, without straitjacking it with unnecessary, heavy, sluggish, and disincenting regulations of the type that the previous FCC chair had imposed.
You know, Jonathan, I hate to cut you short. We're up against a break in a moment, and we will continue on the other side. I wonder, though, if actually it is a restriction. I mean, are broadband companies just not going to invest in broader services because these regulations are there?
The fact is that for the last 2 or 3 years, we've actually been seeing a serial downtick in capital expenditure investment in our broadband networks. The year after the unfortunate decision to impose Title II restrictions were made, that doesn't portend well for the future. We hope we can go back to a future of abundance and not one of austerity when it comes to investing in innovation, investing in our networks, and delivering our consumers the kinds of open internet that they've and services and technologies and applications and content that they've come to enjoy over the years and will continue to enjoy.
Jonathan, hold that thought. We'll continue on the other side of the break as we continue discussing the future of net neutrality. First, we unfortunately have to say goodbye to Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Free Press. I know Tom Wheeler is going to jump in with the point you were just about to make. and Clemson University professor Thomas Hazlitt. We will let them chime in, and we'll continue on the other side. Stay close. Back now to our conversation about the future of net neutrality with Jonathan Spalter, the CEO of U.S. Telecom, Tom Wheeler, the former chairman of the FCC under the Obama administration, and Cecilia Kong, who covers technology for The New York Times. We've been getting a number of great comments from y'all. Greg writes, ask Google, AT&T, Comcast, and Spectrum, if the Title II rules are so onerous, why are they building out their networks so fast? This is about money and control, and once again, the public suffers. Mike in Tulsa writes, envy of the world, broadband is much faster, cheaper, and cleaner in Europe. Jonathan, I have to admit, during the break, I Googled broadband investment, and there's a chart from your organization that shows that since 2002, we've basically been investing around $70-something billion in broadband pretty consistently. Before net neutrality existed, during the recession, it dropped down around the mid to upper 60s in terms of billions, but it's basically kind of been bouncing along in the 60 billion, 70 billion, 75 billion range for the last 15 years. How can we attribute any of this to net neutrality?
Well, look, there's definitely a correlation that we've seen an upward spike in relative rates of capital investment from the earliest moments of the internet until about 2014, when for the first time we actually saw the beginning of a downtick. It was an alarming downtick of about $1 billion in capital expenditures. And we decided to continue to look, as we do annually, at what broadband investment is in our nation's networks. And we've seen that trend continue to be on a downward slope. It is an alarming and I think even portentous signal about where we want to go as a future in terms of the evolution not only of our broadband networks, but the kind of innovative services and products we want to deliver via the internet to more and more Americans. You mentioned, you know, one of your viewers, your listeners, just mentioned Europe. You know, at the outset of the earliest days of the internet, the European governments and the European Union very quickly decided to adopt a much more onerous and heavy approach to the regulatory frameworks that guided the development and growth of internet services across the European landscape. And in fact, what we've seen is capital investment in the United States being two times that per capita of what we've seen in Europe, where speeds, and I do object, speeds tend to be slower and services fewer than Americans can, I think, with great benefit, receive here in our country. You know, the bottom line here is that internet service providers care about their customers, care about their consumers, care about innovation, want to continue to invest in improving services to continue to attract more and more consumers. But in doing so, they also agree firmly with the principles of net neutrality, always have, continue to, and will continue to do so. No throttling, no blocking, no anti-competitive paid prioritization, written in enforceable rules, exactly the kind of clean and modern approach that Chairman Pai wants to take us towards and hopefully Congress will engage in. What we don't agree with is that there's only one true path to net neutrality, well, then is this concept of Title II.
Well, let's get a little bit more into what these are not common topics. Let me get a little bit more into what these common paths look like. We got a number of calls from listeners, some of whom agree with you and believe that the government should take its hands off of this and allow ISPs to build their businesses as they see fit. To be clear, we got plenty of responses of people who said, yes, this makes sense. One of our listeners said she was concerned about how these rule changes could impact access to broadband in rural areas. We heard a little bit about that earlier in our program. Here is what she left in our inbox.
Hi, my name's Sherry. I'm in the Alabama mountains. Most people in Alabama have dial-up. I actually am lucky enough to have a standard service. Our speeds are extremely slow. If net neutrality ceases, I can guarantee my speeds will be even slower. And I also resent the fact that they decided that they can sell my browser history.
Sherry, thank you for calling in with that. So, Jonathan, talk to Sherry. Sell her the kind of plan that she would be able to get in rural Alabama if we remove these net neutrality rules. Sell her on a good plan.
Well, I would tell Sherry that, first of all, U.S. Telecom is an association that represents many ISPs that are serving, in fact, people like you in serving Sherry's families, Sherry's communities, in the most rural parts of our country. Small ISPs that have been around for generations, often family-owned, that have been really bending over backwards to push this log up the hill of continuing to try to find a path to invest in upgrading, modernizing, and evolving networks so that people like Sherry and her community can get increasingly better access to the Internet. What we understand, though, is that when the government decides, as it did 2 years ago via the FCC rule, to impose Title II regulations as a way of what they called saving the Internet, what it meant for these small ISPs that are trying to serve people like Sherry is more onerous types of regulatory overhang, more documents to file, more costs to bear for regulatory compliance, rather than being able to invest in developing, strengthening, making more resilient the networks and pulling more fiber to places where people like Sherry can gain access.
So, Jonathan, I want to make sure that we answer Sherry's question directly. I would guess that Sherry is unmoved by the amount of paper you have to push the Internet to her. What will you be able to do for her if these rules go away? Paint me a picture.
Well, first of all, it will create more incentives and more certainty for Internet service providers to be able to continue to invest at the levels of investment that are going to be required to make sure that those very challenging, both geographically and demographically, parts of the United States that are difficult to reach with Internet can actually get it. They will be more unencumbered by the strictures that are imposed by the straitjacket that regulation often can impose. If, our mantra here is very straightforward. Regulate lightly and carry a big enforcement stick. When Sherry understands that when her Internet service providers can have a clean and modern approach to the evolution of the frameworks that will allow them to continue to invest and innovate without having to do so in an unlevel playing field with the burdens of heavy, heavy regulation akin to what we've seen in the utilities that we all understand, that there will be greater opportunity for her and families like her to have the kinds of Internet access that not only they deserve, but they need. This is a great challenge. We need to be able to deliver more Internet to every American.
Let me let Tom Wheeler back into the conversation. Joshua, Tom, and then I'll come to you, Cecilia. Tom?
Let's go to something else that Sherry said in her comment, where she said that she was worried about the privacy of her browser history. All right? The FCC, using the net neutrality rules, put in place protections for consumer privacy. The Congress, Republican Congress, right after Trump came in, repealed those rules with the support of Jonathan's industry. There can be, under Section 222 of the FCC, of the statute, regulation and protection of consumer privacy, but that goes away if you're not a common carrier, because then you're not regulated under Title II. But there's other fallacies here. You know, Jonathan talks about how ISPs protect their consumers. Well, the whole reason that we've had these multiple court cases saying it has to be Title II is because the FCC was trying to step in when the ISPs weren't doing that. He talks about this highly competitive market. We keep hearing this highly competitive market. Where is the highly competitive market when two-thirds of Americans have only one choice? And then we keep hearing this investment line. You know, the fascinating thing that I learned when I was at the FCC is that you saw one set of statistics that the Internet service providers would bring to the FCC and say, this is what our business looks like. And then you would take and compare them to statistics they gave to the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, where there are penalties for not telling the truth, and they weren't the same. You know, what do they tell the SEC? Where there are penalties for not telling the truth. They tell them that, well, we're going to invest about 15% every year of revenues every year, just like we always have invested. And the interesting thing that's going on is technology is actually helping, because AT&T told the SEC that from year to year, they were able to increase capacity by 250% at 75% of the cost. So you're getting a lot more for a lot less, yet they're still spending 15% of revenue every year. So people are continually getting more. Investment is actually up since the open internet rules.
Cecilia Kang, I wonder if we step back a little bit and talk about, you know, the whole process of how this is playing out. It's arguable that we might not really be having this conversation today if not for John Oliver, who brought up net neutrality over and over again on his show Last Week Tonight.
Kai's main argument is that we don't need Title II to have net neutrality, but some of his ideas for what to have instead are almost laughably lax. For instance, he reportedly floated just having ISPs voluntarily agree not to obstruct or slow consumer access to web content by putting that promise in their terms of service. You know, the things that no human being has ever read and that can change whenever companies want them to. That idea would basically make net neutrality as binding as a proposal on The Bachelor.
That's John Oliver from Last Week Tonight. Cecilia, how much do you get the sense that the public is really fired up about this? Was there really much hue and cry over net neutrality before John Oliver made this a cause célèbre? Or is this one of those things where people say, I don't need to look under the hood of the internet because I don't know what I'm looking at?
He gave it a bump, that is for sure, in 2015. And Tom Wheeler here can attest to that personally. It was... he brought it into the mainstream, but actually there was remarkably a lot of consumer interest in this issue before John Oliver took this. So this is a 13, 14, maybe even arguably 15-year-old issue, that and the internet has progressed quite a bit in that time. And I think only in the last 5 years or so have people really grasp, okay, this is what this issue that I don't quite understand. Whenever I hear the term net neutrality, my brain freezes, which still happens. That concept is slowly getting more into the public consciousness. I do get a lot of people emailing in my inbox. They actually, frankly, this time around, care a lot more about privacy. I've gotten a ton of feedback about Congress's rollback of privacy rules. I think, just to step back, there is currently this feeling, and it actually ironically goes against sort of the Trump administration, what brought the Trump administration into place in the first place, is it goes against some populist beliefs. It's just this idea that to trust your ISP and the fact that there isn't a lot of competition in the ISP market, and which I find quite ironic, because this particular FCC with a Trump appointee in charge right now is doing something that is in some ways arguably sort of anti-populist. It's telling people your company is going to take care of you. Just trust to happen. When there's a lot of feeling that in rural America we're not getting access, we're not getting great service. So I think it'll be interesting to see how things play out. There are a few million comments that flooded into the FCC already. Though I will say at the same time, there is a lot of, I hate to say this, but sort of outrage fatigue. There's a lot of issues going on right now in Washington. And whatever side you're on, it's, you know, there are a lot of issues to try to play on. This one is trying to, you know, may not, no pun intended, get the bandwidth that it would have had a few years ago.
A number of our listeners are also kind of wondering if we're fighting for crumbs at the table. Salada in McLean, Virginia asks, why is the internet so much more expensive here than in Europe? The internet and mobile phones cost a great deal less in Europe. And Andrew in Fort Wayne, Indiana asks, are there other nations with unregulated internet service providers that demonstrate the strengths or weaknesses of the proposed model? Do we know what other countries do with regard to this, Tom?
So it's interesting, you know, the rest of the world really looks to us and follows our lead in many ways. I mean, for instance, after we developed the open internet rules, the net neutrality rules in 2015, the European Union did a similar thing, basing their rules on what we had built. And so the world looks to us. we're a unique situation, and it's difficult to analogize between what's happening in other countries and the size and scope, both geography and economically, of this country.
We're almost out of time, but I wonder, Cecilia, does this look like a done deal? Is there any real possibility of the FCC preserving the net neutrality rules, or is this basically over with?
You know, this administration has rolled back so many Obama-era rules related to telecom and tech policy. So it seems like this would also be an open gate. The thing is, Ajit Pai, the chairman of the FCC, is sitting in a majority right now at the FCC. Congress is also a Republican majority. And Congress right now, the Republicans in Congress, very much support the idea of rolling back Title II and rolling back net neutrality rules. The Trump administration supports this. So when you have all corners of government in support of this, it looks pretty likely that it's going to, his proposal will pass.
Jonathan Spalter, if these net neutrality rules change, how soon will we notice better internet service? What do you think the timeline looks like, briefly?
Well, I hope very quickly. And looking forward, we've been talking about John Oliver's last week tonight. What we're saying here, what we don't want with respect to our internet is the imposition of rules from the last century tomorrow. What we would prefer is, of all of us, in a bipartisan way, take a deep breath, get out a clean sheet of paper, and code smarter, lighter, more nimble, more flexible approaches that is equal to the innovation that we're seeing around us here in Silicon Valley, around the country, so that we can deliver better, more, faster services all around the country, particularly to those Americans that need it most. You know, I talked to lots of folks about their internet services, some good, some bad. Nobody has told me that they want their internet service to look more like their gas company.
And Tom Wheeler, before we go, we're almost out of time, but Tom Wheeler, before we go, you used to be on the industry side of this.
I used to have a job like Jonathan's.
Exactly. What is this like for you watching all this? That you've made quite a change of heart.
No, this is a really simple issue here. What about the people? So when I was in my confirmation hearing in the Senate, they said, hey, look, you used to represent the industry. And I said, my job now is to represent the American consumer. And so the question you have to ask yourself is, what about the people? What about the American consumer? And that's the ultimate responsibility of the FCC.
We'll see what the FCC does going forward. That's Tom Wheeler, the former chair of the FCC, now a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Tom, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thanks, Joshua.
Cecilia Kang, tech reporter at the New York Times. Thank you, Cecilia.
It was a pleasure.
And Jonathan Spalter, the CEO of U.S. Telecom. Thank you, Jonathan.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.